Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
The night before the final, the music's going. The lads would always have a glass of wine or a beer at dinner time. In England, if you get offered a beer, you might have 10.
Headed out as far as McManaman! 2-0 Real Madrid! A huge smile on the face of Steve McManaman.
To ever think that you're going to get to finals, and I was fortunate, I scored in a lot of finals. It certainly, looking back at it, it definitely is a pinch yourself moment.
McManaman with a scissor kick. That has to be the biggest and best goal of the Scouser's career.
I remember going back into the dressing room and everybody singing these Spanish songs, and I'm sort of on the periphery, not knowing a word of these congratulatory Spanish songs.
Once again, Real Madrid as European champions.
I went outside of the dressing room and just sat on the floor and listened to my phone. It was just quite a surreal moment, really.
The year 2000. A new millennium greeted by 2 million people lining the River Thames. A brave new era with Westlife, Dancing in the Moonlight, Big Brother and Rewind. In the Champions League, the first campaign of the new millennium saw the most traditional of all winners, Real Madrid, victors over Valencia in Paris in May. What was a surprise, though, was the man of the match that evening, a young lad from Liverpool who'd ventured abroad the summer before for just such a shot at European glory, only to score in the final one of the all-time great Champions League goals. His name, of course, is Steve McManaman, and he's our guest today. Steve, thank you for being with us today.
Absolute pleasure, mate. Lovely to speak to you, as always.
Well, that's fantastic news. Well, we're here to discuss the Champions League and that May 2000 victory for Real Madrid. Real Madrid, though, and the Champions League, just from the outside, it does seem a bit of an obsession at that club. What's it like as a player?
Well, they're not necessarily obsessed with it, James, like you'd think they are. It's just every single season, a club of that size and a club of that magnitude wants to be successful in every cup competition. Mm. It's just that I don't know whether they just find it a lot easier to win because it's a knockout competition, whether they feel that, you know, it's a trophy that they should win. They always have a feeling that they're one of the best teams in the world. That goes without saying. And the fact that in 2000, when we arrived there, they won it 2 years prior in 98. And they always feel as if they've got a chance in winning it, to be honest. And no matter how the league season's going, once the knockout stage of that competition comes around, they always feel as if they've got a great chance.
Yeah, something in their DNA just kicks in. As you mentioned it, they'd won 2 years before. They won it the year with you, and then, of course, you picked up another one afterwards. But we're here really today to talk about the Valencia game. And I imagine that must be one of your all-time great football memories, not just the goal, but the whole game.
Yes, because it went fairly, as football matches go, of course, there was a lot of butterflies, a lot of nerves before the game. But the game went quite comfortable, to be honest. We were well on top. I mean, the first half was quite close and quite tense, as you can imagine. But we were quite comfortable within the game. We scored late on in the first half to go 1-0 up at half-time. And apart from a few little moments in the second half, we always felt as if we were going to win the game. I scored the second, which gave us a little bit of breathing space. But once the second went in, you almost visibly saw them deflate. And, you know, Raul scored the third, I don't know, about 10 minutes after I scored the second. And you can sort of enjoy a game. You never enjoy football matches until the final whistle goes. But actually, you could enjoy this, and it arguably being the biggest game of the season, to sort of sit and take in the crowd and hear the olés with 15 minutes of a game to go of that magnitude. It was quite surreal. You know, 2 years later when we won it, we were hanging on. Lucky to survive. We had the goalkeeper to thank. We were so lucky that we didn't concede the equaliser in 2002. But, you know, this game in 2000, we sat and enjoyed. Well, sat. We played the last 15 minutes out knowing that there was no way back for this Valencia team. And it was a stroll to the final whistle, which was really, really enjoyable, to be very honest.
And for you in particular, coming at the end of a season which had involved a pretty big risk on your part, moving countries, leaving Liverpool behind, leaving your home city behind, and making this move to one of, if not the biggest club in the world, and a completely new set of players, completely new language, etc., for you to be able to enjoy the fact that you'd had the ultimate success, really. With we'll come onto the game in all its glory very shortly. But can I just ask about how was it that you were in Madrid? What brought about you making the move and becoming the first English player to actually move to Spain since Gary Lineker back in 86?
Well, there was a number of reasons, really. My contract situation with Liverpool wasn't coming to a head. It was starting to run down. In the summer, Roy Evans thought he was acquiring a new coach, which turned into a joint manager. So that undermined him a great deal. And I had a lot of respect for Roy Evans as a manager and as a person. I didn't enjoy that. And the start of the new season with Liverpool, having joint managers was very surreal, because if you won the game, it was because of Gerard Houllier's influence. If you lost the game, it was because of Roy Evans. So you knew that the two couldn't survive in that current guise and that current role. You know, I was thinking about, you know, maybe this is the time, because Liverpool were in a little bit of a transitional period at the time with Gerard Houllier coming in. I mean, I respected Gerard as a manager, no problem at all. He was very good with me. But I just thought, I hadn't played in the Champions League. I hadn't played against the best players in Europe. I had an international level, but I hadn't done at club level. Right. And I just felt that I needed to have a change. I needed to go. And my mother was very ill at that last year of my time at Liverpool. And she subsequently passed away. Well, the day after I played my last game at Anfield and I finished the season, she passed away then. And I just knew that it was time for me to have a new challenge. It was time for me to make the jump from, you know, living in Liverpool all my life and trying somewhere else, learn a new culture, learn a new lifestyle, et cetera, et cetera, trying to learn a new language and put myself in a difficult situation just to see how I'd react and how I would evolve.
All right. What marks would you give yourself out of 10 for how you reacted to your new situation?
I was fine. You know what, James? I was lucky. I mean, lucky in the fact that I didn't have any children at the time, so that helped me. As in, you know, you're not worrying about two little kids and finding schools, et cetera, et cetera. I went over. It was just me and my wife, my girlfriend at the time, now my wife, and we went over sort of in secret about 6 weeks before I was due to have my first day in pre-season with Madrid. And I went house hunting. I wanted to find a house. I didn't want to live in a hotel with suitcases scattered all around it. I wanted a house, an apartment. I wanted somewhere where I could reside straight away. So I went over, had a weekend just house hunting all over Spain. And there was, you know what the Spanish media, like, there was sightings of this new signing, but no one could ever pin me down of where I was around Madrid. And I found a house and I sorted out all the documentation.
It was Christian Panucci's old house, no?
Christian Panucci's old house, yes. And I've actually bumped into Christian on a plane when he was going over to finalise him leaving, and I was coming over to finalise like my niece staying. And he said, oh, you have to look at my house anyway. 10 houses, 15 apartments later, I went to see his house and we said, brilliant, this is the house. And, you know, I started all the paperwork off. So when I did go over 6 weeks later to sort of live, I jumped into this new house. I went on pre-season tour for 2 weeks to Austria and up in the mountains. And by the time I'd come back, my wife had furnished it, had put, you know, the televisions in. I put my suitcases down and I was settled. A couple of weeks later, my wife got a job in the in one of the universities teaching Spanish lawyers English law. So she was happy. The weight of your world off your shoulders when your wife goes to work every day and has a social life and you're away a lot of the time because the foreign teams, you know, we were away two nights before games and things like that. As you probably know from your Italian connections, you're away a lot longer than you are when you played for an English team. So she was happy at a house. So I could really throw myself into trying to integrate with the team and trying to, you know, be one of the lads and spend as much time with the boys as possible and showing them that even though I was short on the language, you know, I was quite happy to sit with them for hours on end and not necessarily converse with them. But I was a good guy, if that makes sense.
Oh, no, totally. But I imagine that walking into a new dressing room is always a daunting prospect, no matter what you've done and where you've been before, and particularly when it's a new dressing room at Real Madrid with players of the caliber of Raul, etc., and you don't speak the language, so you already feel a little bit awkward, perhaps.
Yeah.
How daunting was the first day when you walked in? I mean, did you know where to sit? You know, what the kind of hierarchy was?
Absolutely not. No, I didn't know where to sit at all. And what happens is that season they'd had an unsuccessful season, and there was a lot of negativity around the squad. There was a lot of big players with big egos, but actually, I think we brought in about four or five new players. I think Jeremy came in from Turkey, Cameroon lad. He spoke English, actually. Mm. And there was another lad, a Bosnian lad, Elvia Balic. He spoke a bit of English. And then there was Christian Karambu who spoke it. Clarence Seydorf spoke it. But Clarence got moved on after about a month or so, right, since I was there. Christian Panucci left. Davos Sukar had left. Pedro Mijatovic had left. Real big characters. So actually, the dressing room itself was quite calm because a lot of the characters had left. But, you know, I was still petrified when I went in and I didn't know where to sit. And, you know, you bump into Raul's and then Manolo Sanchez and Fernando Hierro's, Clarence Seydorf's, of course. And it's just a question of, you know, smiling at them, thumbs up to a lot of them. And, I mean, at the time, I signed, it was Gus Hiddink was manager. But by the time I arrived, John Toshak was manager, of course, who I knew Tosh from, you know, from Liverpool. And a lot of the exercises we did in training were exercises started by Bill Shankly. So I knew all the exercises off by heart when I was warming up in training. So it was actually quite surreal to go from Liverpool and join into, you know, a training ground, which, you know, which consisted of a lot of Liverpool exercises by an old ex-Liverpool player.
Perfect. As you say, though, it was pretty much the day after you'd arrived and made your first kind of had your first training session there with the club in Madrid that you were all whisked off to Austria. So at that point, very much a crash course. Were you learning Spanish kind of in the background or how did that work?
Yes, funny enough, I told Liverpool that I wanted to leave, if I can remember rightly, something like November or something like that. And there was an opportunity for me to go to Italy round about then. And I started taking Italian lessons. Mm. And anyway, Liverpool decided they didn't want to sell me for a nominal fee and they'll keep me to the end of the season and let my contract run out. And then come January, when I knew I was, January, February, whenever it was, when I was decided to join Real Madrid, I started taking Spanish lessons. Initially, I had them in the house, but I was still living with my mother and father to a certain extent at the time because I spent a lot of time in the house. And then I stopped having them in the house because my mother was too ill and she was bedbound upstairs. So I just started taking them, speaking to my Spanish lecturer. But I had them intensely when I got to Madrid, really. I had my little phrase book when I was in Austria and trying to learn as much as I could while you're on the go. But it was...
What was your go-to phrase, Steve?
It probably involves a couple of swear words and things like that. But I got put with a Spanish lad. I roomed with a Spanish lad while I was there called Manolo Cannavale, who was a lovely lad, lovely, lovely lad, who didn't speak a word of English. And I didn't speak a word of Spanish at the time, a little conversational Spanish, of course. So we just got by and became great friends just by, you know, shouting at each other. And, you know, it's just all stupid childlike stuff. But it was very fond memories at the time, even though I felt quite lonely. And, you know, at the time, you just have to get on with it. I knew it was going to be like that. I didn't think it was going to be anything else. So this wasn't a shock to me. It was just the stage you have to get through.
I was curious about that, about whether it was the way you'd imagined. When a player is offered the chance to go and join Real Madrid, I guess you can imagine the fans, the glory, etc. But the actual mechanics of trying to fit in with a new set of players in a foreign language and a new home and everything else that entails, particularly when the season doesn't actually start that well. I mean, it had a fantastic finale, but the early months of the campaign, Real were in all sorts of trouble. No, you dropped as low as, 17th? Change manager, Toshak goes, Del Bosque comes in.
Yeah, it was. We didn't start well. We had a number of injuries. There was a number of people in fighting. John Toshak was arguing with the board a lot. Nicholas Anelka came in and he didn't get on well with a lot of the players.
You were his roommate, no?
Yeah, we had. Because of course I played in England and he had as well. So it was all a little bit strange. Then we had to go to that silly tournament in Brazil, if I remember, which set us back. We had five games in hand on teams, but we had to play, you know, five games in 10 days or something like that when we returned. I mean, it was just quite a surreal season until we got to sort of the February when things started to settle down and we started to play in the knockout stage of the Champions League. And I don't know whether injuries made us go to five at the back, but the five people we had at the back, and we had Fernando Hierro, and as I said to you before, Manolo Sanchez in our squad, but they were injured. And we ended up with Elguera, Ivan Campo, and Aitor Karanka. Of course, the wing backs of Roberto and Michel Salgado. And something just clicked in the team, and we suddenly started churning out really, really impressive, impressive performances, particularly in the Champions League.
All right. Roberto being Roberto Carlos, what was he like?
Brilliant. I mean, you must know a lot of the Brazilians when you come across them. Always got a smile on the face, always enjoy themselves.
Biggest thighs in football ever, no?
Biggest thighs in football, but an athlete, a real athlete, up and down the pitch, no problem at all, wanted to work hard. Great, great teammate to have. Still see him a lot nowadays, but all the Brazilians I knew were all the same. All great, all love life, love playing football, just wanted to enjoy themselves on and off the field, but incredibly professional and, you know, extremely talented on it.
Yeah. Some of the other figures in that team, Raul, who's kind of a legend, and I kind of imagine that he might have been the personality that kind of overshadowed the whole dressing room. But when you talk about the things that happened in that season to turn things around, the arrival of Iker Casillas, plucked almost from his school desk to be the starting keeper, must have been extraordinary.
Yeah, it was extraordinary. And it's funny when you think of the career he's had now, best friends with the King of Spain and won the World Cups and the trophies he lifted. But going back then, you know, getting off the bus or getting off the tram to come in, and Bodo Ilner was injured, Albano Bizzarri played, but, you know, really struggled and really struggled with the with a confidence issue. And then suddenly this young kid is chucked in, who hasn't got the stature or the physique of an imposing goalkeeper, yet turns into this incredible, wonderful shot stopper. You know, it is fairy tale stuff when you go back to it, to how he started and, you know, how he progressed through the team.
Yeah, you were talking about the Champions League, and this was back in the day when UEFA and their wisdom had a second group stage, which you were lumped in with Bayern Munich, which didn't work out too well. A couple of heavy defeats there from the
Bavarians. Yeah.
Who were smarting themselves from their final defeat to Manchester United in the previous season's edition. As it turned out, you went into the final game of that second group stage needing a victory away at Rosenborg to go through. Were there a lot of nerves about that, or was it, we are Real Madrid, we'll handle this?
Yeah, I think there was nerves, but I think there was always a case of, don't worry, we'll handle it. Mm. And it was a very physical game, you remember. I think John Carew played up front. You know, he was a big, tough lad, and the weather wasn't great, as you could, of course, you can imagine. But that wasn't an issue at all. You knew you had to get through these games, and it was just another stepping stone to get to where we should be. Yeah, I remember getting through, and you know, it was a battle, but I don't think it was a particularly difficult game to accomplish, to be very honest.
Yeah, well, a 1-0 victory. Who scored then? Do you remember?
No idea. Right, okay. Raul, no idea.
Well, you probably remember who scored in the next stage then, because this took you back to England to take on Manchester United, who were the reigning European champions at the time.
Yeah.
0-0 at the Bernabeu in the first leg. The second leg then, you go to Old Trafford. What do you recall of this game?
I remember the 0-0 game, we were very good. We were quite dominant, and I think it might have been Mark Bosnich in goal for them. Not entirely sure, but anyway, he had a really good game, saved, and we should have been leading. We should have gone to Old Trafford ahead 1-0, 2-0, if I can remember rightly. Played very well, so we went to Old Trafford again, really confident. At that time, when we got through, something had clicked. So from the Rosenborg to the United game, we felt as if we were not a different team, but a much better team. Much better team. We went to United full of confidence because the way they played suited the way we played. United like to come out and play expansive football. We always felt we could do that, and we had extremely talented players. I know Raul scored.
He did.
The one from the Redondo flick. I mean,
that's Roy Keane's own goal was the first one. What Redondo did, though, to set up Raul, what was the reaction of the rest of the team when you went in at full time? I mean, you went 3-0 up, basically. Then they came back. Yeah. But it was an astonishingly confident performance from Real Madrid the European Champions. But when you got back into the dressing room, was everyone just staring at Redondo saying, what have you done?
Well, he was a glorious player, and it was a real pity that he left at the end of the season. He got that terrible injury.
Never
played again. I think that year he got like sort of Champions League player of the season. It showed how good he was. So it wasn't a shock that he did that. I loved his composure after that, where he gathered the ball because he was still, you know, wide, and he took another couple of touches and took his time and then rolled it to Raul and, you know, literally put it on a plate for him. But it was just the whole move. Yes, his skill was glorious, but it was what he did after that really impressed me. I'd seen him. He was a big, tall, elegant Argentinian player with graceful feet, and it didn't surprise me. I remember our lads were astounded with the reaction of the Man United fans after the game, because Man United fans gave them a really warm applause at the end. I think they knew they were beaten by a better team over the two legs, and they'd seen something good. I got dogs abuse, of course, as you can imagine, as a scouser even, but our lads really appreciated that. They thought the English fans were brilliant, because you don't normally get round of applauses when you leave. And a couple of years later, when Ronaldo scored the hat-trick and we beat them again, Ronaldo got a round of applause, and at the end of the game, a round of applause was given to us as we knocked them out. And you don't normally see that in European football. So that was one of the overriding memories of that, leaving the pitch and going into the dressing room. I mean, of course, I was ecstatic. Yeah. I had family members there who were watching the game, and they couldn't believe how well we played.
Yeah. Just for anyone who didn't see it, would you describe what Redondo did to Henning Berg that day?
Well, he sort of backheels it, doesn't he?
Yeah, so they're racing down the sideline. The corner is approaching very, very quickly indeed, and you think Redondo's run out of room, that Berg's done the job. But without breaking stride, he somehow backheel nutmegs him and then goes round, and as you say, as if it was completely normal, picks the ball up, takes a touch or two, and then sees Raul and slides it across for him.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah, and I was just behind Raul, if he would have missed it for a tap-in. That was the only thing. But never mind, you can't have everything, mate. You can't have everything.
Indeed not. Anyway, so you get past Man United with that victory, and then it's Bayern again. Bayern, who, if anyone through that season had looked like maybe the side on a mission, it was them. As I say, 4-2, they'd beaten you in the second group, and then 4-1. And smarting from that last second defeat to Man United in the final the previous year. Was it, as you say, the fact that you'd clicked after getting past Rosenberg, that this time when you faced them, you win the first leg 2-0. The second leg, you lose 2-1 away in Munich, but I mean, you're through.
Yes, I think it was, James. We clicked and we went to five at the back, if I can remember. And it really suited the way we played. Really suited the way we played. I mean, Bayern were the dominant team then. They should have won in 99. They beat us really easily in the group stages. And of course, they did knock us out the following year. They were excellent. And then we beat them again in 2002, I think. So they were really the team, that the benchmark of European football. When you knew and faced them with Effenberg and Oliver Kahn and Lizarazu, they were a superb team, superb team. So we knew that we had to do something different and play better. And we were at the Bernabeu. We were excellent. Really, really good at the Bernabeu. It was hard when we went over to the Olympic Stadium, like it always is. We hung on. We played well. We hung on. But I think it was simply because we went to five at the back. I mean, even our midfield, you know, if I can remember rightly, we had Redondo, me and Raul in midfield, which is a very strange three to have. And then Anelka and Morientes. Right. So, you know, the team itself was very strange the way we played. You know, I was a sitting midfielder with Redondo, with Raul slightly in front of us, and then Morientes and Anelka. So when you think of that and where everybody played, you wonder how, but it just happened. Del Bosque found a way to keep this team happy and keep it all fit. Those performances, Man U and Bayern, and then subsequently the final, we finished the season off really, really well.
Well, I would say so, yeah.
The Millennium Final between Real Madrid and Valencia was staged in Paris and was the first ever European Cup or UEFA Champions League final to be contested between two clubs from the same country. Madrid were looking to lift the trophy for an eighth time. Valencia, though, had to pre-qualify to get into the tournament. Vicente Del Bosque was looking for his first European trophy as manager of Los Blancos after a disappointing league season, which had seen them finish fifth.
Amongst those in the Real Madrid side chasing double Champions League success are Roberto Carlos, Fernando Morientes and Raul, while Steve McManaman could be the first Englishman to become a European champion with a non-English side.
So there you are, the final, 24th of May 2000. It's the second final in three seasons for Real Madrid, but for you, your first ever. And exactly, I mean, this is everything that you had left Liverpool for. How did you feel?
I was absolutely thrilled to bits, James, to reach the final. Of course I was. I didn't necessarily think I was vindication of me leaving, because it was too soon. And now the move itself, even if I would have left trophyless after a couple of years, was still the right move.
Right.
Because it would always be the right move. I adore Spain now. That's part of the reason why. But to get to a final, it's just amazing, isn't it? And especially the Champions League final. You know, I played in the FA Cup final. I played in the League Cup final. No, I hadn't won a league as of yet in 2000. But to get to the Champions League, which I'd watched a year before, I watched the Bayern Munich-Manchester United game and couldn't believe it, how it finished and the results. And I'd watched subsequent games before that. And I was embedded in it by playing with Liverpool and seeing Alan Kennedy scored in 81 and 84, you know, and things like that. So I knew what it was all about. So it was a huge occasion for me and, you know, all my family members who came over to watch.
How big was the McManaman party?
Oh, I must have had about 19 dads and all those mates. As I said, my mother had passed about a year before, or just less than a year before. It was a big moment for everybody because I left the family house. I left my father, who I was extremely close to and went to every single football match. And he'd lost his life partner, of course, as my mother, and he'd lost me as well. So yeah. He didn't watch me play football live. He had a couple of times, of course, that year. He'd come to Spain, he'd watched the Man United game, but he hadn't been to many games. So him and a lot of his friends came over, my sister and my brother and my wife and her family. So it was a big, big occasion for everybody.
Is that in your mind when you step onto the field, when the whistle blows, or does that just kind of get put to one side because of the game?
Yeah, it gets put to one side. The game is everything. That's all I was thinking about beforehand. The game, preparation, sleeping, eating, you know, getting to the dressing room, preparing correctly and getting on with the game.
History is created. The first ever European Cup final between two countries from the same nation.
So the match is against Real Madrid. They'd face Barcelona in their semi-final. Who were Real Madrid rooting for? Were they kind of hoping for a kind of El Clasico Champions League final?
Probably not. I think any time you could see Barcelona getting beat is a good time, isn't it? So they were probably rooting for Valencia.
Right.
I think so.
That's who you got. You mentioned the build-up in your book El Maca, which is a fascinating snapshot of only a couple of decades ago, but already a slightly different age in football. The build-up is something that really strikes me in that everything seems unbelievably relaxed. It's like you're on holiday or something. You're all kind of running around doing piggyback bumper cars and stuff like that.
Yeah. I was amazed by it all. You know, when I was in Liverpool, you were in your room at 10:30 and this and that, and, you know, just relaxing. But the night before the final, people were getting massages at 12:30, 1:00. The music's going. The lads would always have a glass of wine or a beer at dinner time, which, of course, was frowned on incredibly in England to have a beer with your evening meal. So it was really, really relaxed. But I think that's just, I mean, it's just the European way of life, isn't it? You know, in England, if you get offered a beer, you might have 10. In Spain, if you're offered a beer, you'll have one or you'll have a glass of wine. And that's the end of it. They know when to say, right, that's enough. And now it's dinner time, and don't have coffee before dinner because it fills you up. You need food. You need the fuel. So it was a completely different scenario there. And a lot of these players have been involved 2 years ago. So it was just, this is what we do and let's get on with it.
What stage did the nerves kick in finally?
I was always quite relaxed, to be honest, James. Of course, I would have been nervous. Of course, I would have had butterflies in the stomach. But as soon as you walk onto the pitch, that's when you're ready to go. That's when your nerves probably just turn to adrenaline, turn to excitement, turn to a thing where you just can't wait to get on with it. And you want your first touch to be a good touch. And then you feel as if you're confident. You want to do something then on the pitch, which makes you think, oh, yeah, you know, that I've settled into this game.
McManaman started running and kept on running to win Real a throw. Didn't manage to beat Valencia in either league meeting this season. 3-2 win for Valencia in Madrid, a 1-1 draw at the Mestalla. Oh, good save from Canizares. Gets down to keep out McManaman.
Sometimes when you get on, and if you make a mistake straight away, if you make another mistake, you might think, oh, it's going to be one of those days. So you just want everything to go as well as you can early on. Feel it in your teammates, and then you start to suss out the opposition and see how they're doing. And if you've got the better of the person you're up against, can you go past him? How's his touch? Is he feeling nervous? And then you judge the game as you move on.
Who were you up against?
It would have been someone like Gerardo. Mendieta played there, didn't he? He might have played wide. You know, we played very centrally. Farinos, you know, there was a couple in there. Piojo Lopez played further forward. But Anglomar was on one side as a right back. They played in a four, didn't he? So you would have come across everybody playing in that. Because we played with a three, we were very mobile in there. So you could play against anybody. You know, Roberto Carlos played as a wing back. He was up and down the field, you know, like a madman at times. So was Salgado.
McManaman, nice exchange with Michel Salgado. And then with Anelka. Roberto Carlos finds Raul. Good save by Canizares.
You'd have to cover for each other wherever they went, particularly playing in the position I was.
They had had a much better season in the league, at least, than Real Madrid.
Yeah.
And I think it was a surprise for most observers how one-sided the final turned out to be. The first half, well, it was 40 minutes in or 39 minutes in when Fernando Morientes puts you into the lead.
Anelka. Salgado keeps it going. wing, and it's in from Morientes. And we're all the way through to half-time. Valencia had the better of the early stages, but it's Real Madrid who have the nod at the break. Real 1, Valencia 0.
I think everybody felt that it was comfortable. Their danger men, and they had a lot, were not as dangerous as we thought they were going to be. Our defenders suffocated them to a certain extent. They never really had a lot of chances. There was a few half chances, but we felt, you know, if we keep on doing this, we've got them. We were better on the ball than them. And we felt supremely confident, really, as the game wore on.
Okay. Well, there was only one goal in it until sort of midway through the second half when via Golazo de McManaman. That ticker on your jersey.
Roberto Carlos. Headed out as far as McManaman! 2-0 Real Madrid! A huge smile on the face of Steve McManaman. Mobbed by his teammates. After a volley that gives Real Madrid a little bit of breathing space.
It's like when I head the ball, I said, oh, I closed my eyes, but not yet. I knew I was quite adept, actually, James, at those type of volleys. I found them quite comfortable.
How would you describe that type of volley?
I had to have both feet off the ground so I could elevate myself because I wanted to hit the ball as early as I could.
Okay.
Because every time, of course, the more time you let the ball drop, the more time because someone's going to try and get a block.
Right.
So I was quite happy to jump in the air and elevate myself and get the volley away with both feet off the ground. I could do it quite comfortably. It was easy for me to do, even though it's a hard volley to attempt. Mm. I could actually, I felt I could do that quite easily.
So it's an astonishing volley to watch, firstly because of the technique, the kind of karate kick, the double leg action, but also the placement, because it's not like you just hit it straight ahead of you and in it goes. Mm. You place it beautifully.
Yeah. Again, it wasn't just thrashed at it because I was there. I could control the ball really easy. And the way I jumped up, I knew that I could control my feet, so I'd never get under the ball. So it was never going to go high. And it was always a case of just getting the placement in and just not hitting it anywhere. I could hit them hard as well, and I could hit them without bouncing. But this one where the bodies were in the box, it was just about diverting it away from any of my teammates and defenders so it wouldn't hit them, and trying to place it into the corner.
And after all that, it's a pretty nonchalant jog away from the Scouser. McManaman with a scissor kick. Camisari's unsighted by Pellegrino. That has to be the biggest and best goal of the Scouser's career.
Steve, you played in a lot of football matches and you scored a large number of goals as well, but was that one of your kind of you had to pinch yourself moments of your career?
Yeah, I think so. Only because we won the game, James. And I look back and that made it 2-0, which gave us a little bit of breathing space within the game. And I run towards my family. So I mean, when I very rarely celebrated a lot when I scored goals, but I celebrated that particular day and run over to my father and all the family because they were behind sort of the Real Madrid bench. I knew where they were. I was quickly composed and get back on, but it's certainly a pinch yourself moment. You know, watching, as I said to you, watching Liverpool scoring in Champions Leagues and thinking to yourself, wow, you know, in 81 I was 9, in 84 I'm 12, and then I go and watch Everton, my first time at Wembley. So to ever think that you're going to get to finals, and I was fortunate, I scored in a lot of finals. I was not like a regular goal scorer, but I scored in the big games and I played well in finals. I was, you know, so it certainly, looking back at it, it definitely is a pinch yourself moment.
There's still a bit of time for Valencia. There's plenty of shirts forward for them here. It flicks off the head of Miguel Angulo. And Real Madrid might be away. It's Raul to run away. They won't catch him. It's just a question of whether he can keep his cool or not. Oh, can he? Can he? Raul Gonzalez finishes it off. No way back for Valencia now. The golden boy of the Bernabeu has sealed it.
I was closest to him, I think, when he scored it. I set off behind him. And then when he goes round the goalkeeper, again, if anything would have happened or the despairing defender would have stopped it, I may have had to tap in.
Right.
So I was with him, but Savio sets him off. And I mean, the third goal, you could see that they've gone because they've left one of the greatest Spanish marksmen in the history alone for, you know, a 60-yard isolated run to go round the goalkeeper. You could see they gambled on everything at that moment.
It's Redondo. Now Roberto Carlos, who can celebrate on the run as the final whistle sounds. A whistle that confirms, once again, Real Madrid as European champions. Morientes, McManaman and Raul. Real 3, Valencia 0.
Beyond the goal, your teammates, the commentators, I think there's pretty much unanimous agreement that you were the man of the match. You were running the show. Do you know how many miles you ran that night?
No. I mean, running was never a problem for me, James. It was everything else. So, I could always run. There was no issue for me. I never looked at my stats. No.
Beyond the distance, though, the fact that you were so much at the heart of how Real Madrid played. You were a guy who turned up less than a year before, who'd kind of tiptoed into that dressing room, but had won the trust of that group of players and was kind of almost that night handed the reins to the team.
Yeah, I mean, it was fantastic. I remember going back into the dressing room and everybody singing these Spanish songs, and I'm sort of on the periphery, not knowing a word of these congratulatory Spanish songs. And I'm sort of just jumping around, feeling a little bit like, what am I doing? You know what? I'm not singing any songs. I don't know what anybody's singing. And I just took myself off and sat down, and I put my phone on, and I had like congratulatory messages from, you know, a lot of my teammates at Liverpool and people. And I went outside at the dressing room and just sat on the floor and listened to my phone. It was just quite a surreal moment, really.
Steve, I was going to say relentlessly upbeat, but I mean, you are a naturally extremely positive person, which I think is one of the reasons that you've been such a success. But that does sound quite a poignant moment, almost. You just had the biggest success of your career, and now there's almost this very lonely sensation of
it was a very surreal moment, mate. It was quite lonely because I couldn't really celebrate, and I thought if I did this 12 months ago with my Liverpool teammates, I would have been right in the heart of everything, and it would have been this explosive celebratory moment. But it actually wasn't. I felt a little bit, a fraud's the wrong word, but it just felt as if I was so on the periphery because I couldn't completely throw myself in. Right. And it just felt a little bit of I consider myself, you know, a bit cool. I don't go in for all those celebratory moments. I just thought to myself, I know, you look a bit of an idiot jumping in like this, not singing any words. So I just thought, you know what? I'll chill, I'll get my phone, and I'll just sit outside. And it was one of those moments I just thought, you know, that's what I'll do. And I remembered my poor mother, and I just sat on the floor for a moment before going back inside, and sort of the celebratory songs had calmed down a bit, and people were, you know, starting to just chill out and have a beer and start to relax. And then the president came down. But yeah, that initial 10 or 15 minutes getting into the dressing room, I just felt as if, you know, I wasn't really there.
I imagine as well there's like a surge of adrenaline that's coming. How long was it before you could meet up with Victoria and your family and your father?
I met Victoria straight away, and then Real Madrid had organised like this 1,000-seater banquet in some godforsaken hotel, and it was just an awful, awful evening. I'd sat at a long table, couldn't get a beer, you know.
You couldn't get a beer?
Because there were so many people in this banquet and probably not enough staff, and I was like, can I have a beer? And they'd bring one, and by the time I ordered the next one, I'd wait another half an hour, and then I remember I remember speaking to my father and my mates who partied all around Paris till 9 o'clock the following morning. I think I was tucked up in bed, sober as a judge, I think. So it wasn't them. It was a great win, and it was an awful celebration afterwards.
All right. Okay. Was it any better in a couple of years after when you won again?
Again, it was, we had like a banquet organised. Right. So it was sort of a sit-down meal where we had lots of directors and their families. So it became a huge event where everybody, you were celebrating it with people that, I mean, I hardly knew, and the trophy was on a stage and people would get on the stage. So it wasn't this relaxed, let's just go and have a big party and get the music pumping and the trophies there. So it was very much of a, like an event rather than, you know, a celebration. Yeah. So it was better. It was better because I had some family and friends were invited. But the first time around, I thought it was just going to be this explosive big party. And, you know, unfortunately, it wasn't.
Okay, but when you flew back to Madrid as European champions, what was that like?
That was just crazy, mate, crazy. You know, I'd never seen the streets lined with that amount of people. You go to the, you know, the church, you go to the town hall, you meet everybody. But that was, you know, that was just truly amazing seeing everybody on the streets going around But unfortunately, that didn't last long because I think the following day I had to meet up with England. Mm. You're in and you're out, you know, because it was of course, the €2,000.
Yeah, of course.
So
yeah.
I think I flew to England early the next day, saw my family. I met up in down at whatever it was, at Burnham Beaches or something like that, or wherever we met up. So it was the turnaround was just, you know, you couldn't really, really enjoy it. It would have been nice to stay in Madrid for a week and sort of, you know, enjoy the atmosphere and enjoy it with the fans. But as it is now, you're just in and out, aren't you? You see it this year. After the finals this year, the players were meeting up for those silly Nation League games and things like that. So it was, it's all on to the next one all the time.
Yeah, crazy world of a footballer. As we say, there was a next one for you 2 years after. You contributed what must have been an almost a sweet goal in the semi-final of that magnificent little chip against Barcelona, yeah, in the semi. As you guys won, what was it, 2-0 at the Camp Nou?
Yes, we won 2-0 at the Camp Nou and played really well, James, again. Zizou scored the first, I scored the second. And I didn't realise, but when I walked off, we were 2-0 up, of course, so you're effectively in the final without being blasé and showing Barcelona no disrespect. But our Spanish players went crazy in the dressing room celebrating, and I couldn't believe it. I was like, you know what? And by all accounts, it was the first time they'd won there in a long time.
Since 83, and, yeah.
Yeah, and it was, again, it was slightly lost on me because I didn't have the passion or the history of a Madridista, but they knew it was a massive, massive deal. And we felt as if, and they felt that we were through. We played them. They were nowhere near as good as us. And we knew we were not getting beat 3-0 back at home. There was no chance of that. With the hatred that goes on between the two teams and with the atmosphere the way it is, we knew we were not losing that game. It wasn't a cruise to the final, of course. It was 1-1 the second game, but we knew we were effectively there. The first leg was a punishing result for them and a big blow for them.
A magnificent palmares from your time in Madrid. I think you played in 11 finals and won 8 trophies.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, of course, you play in those, what do you call the world?
Yeah, you got the Intercontinental Cup, you won that.
That's what it's called,
Spanish,
yeah.
Super Cup, and included. You know, but okay, you got 2 Liga like titles that, and you got a couple of Champions Leagues as well, and a European Super Cup. Yeah. We'll throw that in as well.
Yeah, 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 yeah. I mean, they're all nice. You know, playing the Copa Libertadores champions, you're lucky enough to do that only when you win the Champions League. But to play that, we played Boca Juniors and lost, actually, in Tokyo. Mm. But again, that's surreal because you're meeting a team from Argentina. They brought thousands and thousands and thousands of fans to Tokyo. We thought it was just some exhibition game. Of course, you wanted to win it, but Real Madrid must have had 25 fans there and, you know, a man with his dog. They brought thousands, and you really appreciate what football means to various people when you travel around the globe playing these type of games. You know, Riquelme and Palermo up front, and it was great names that you saw on the television. Mm. And to play them in a game in Tokyo, and they had the place rocking there, the Boca Juniors fans. So that was a great occasion. So that's what you miss when you were, you know, when you stop playing.
Yeah, what are the standout memories that you take from your time at Real Madrid, and particularly the Valencia game? Is there the goal, I imagine, but is there something beyond that that you, when you think of that game, that's what springs to mind?
Yeah, it's mainly the goal. It's mainly the way we finished the game. I remember like moments where the fans were singing "Olé, olé," and we were messing around with the ball, and you know they couldn't get it back off us, and in the end they had to foul us. And you think when that happens, you know that in your minds, this game's done. And you can sort of really think back and relax. But, you know, many occasions, those teammates I had, you know, are friends now. I speak to them regularly. We've got the customary WhatsApp group. I'm still involved in the Real Madrid Old Boys games. Right. I try and go over a lot. I go a lot because, of course, through work, I go a lot to the Bernabeu for the Champions League game. So I see everybody there. They've still got some of the kit men. Some of the physios are still there now. You know, 20 years later, they're still working for them. And that's what I absolutely love about Madrid, to a certain extent, like Liverpool. Yes, they're a huge billion-dollar company, but they're still very much in that sphere of the training ground. They're very much a family-run club, and they look after people who have been there for a long time. As I said, some of the kit men can't even lift the kit bags anymore. They're too heavy. But you know what? They just get younger men to help them. They don't get rid of them. They keep them on, and they get younger men to help them. And I just love that about the club. So I love going back and seeing, you know, Raul's involved, of course. He's with Castilla. Roberto Carlos is an ambassador. Iker Casillas is involved now. You know, so all these people are still involved. So when you go back, you catch up with them. A lot of the players who I played with all live in Madrid. Ronaldo's in the house. Luis Figo lives there. Zizou lives there. You know, they all reside somewhere there. And that's, I think that shows what a special city and a special football club it is when everybody's after everything and where they've lived all around the world all still seem to reside in Madrid.
Yeah, no doubt. That loyalty to the off-field staff, not always shown towards the manager, of course, but also the players. I mean, you had four seasons there and you won so much, but you had to battle so much as well.
To
stay in their plans. I mean, one season you started off without even a squad number.
Well, that's what they threatened me. Yeah, I mean, it was never going to happen, but that's what they threatened. And it was the same with Fernando Redondo. It was the year after when Florentino came in. And I think if you speak to Florentino now, I think he learned from what his first tenure at Madrid and what went wrong. Because now it's completely the opposite. Squad full of internationals and superstars. You know, he lets people stay for 8, 9, 10 years. When back in his first stint as president, he wanted a lot of the younger kids coming into the team because he could pay them less. He wanted a lot of the older players out. He thought he could chop and change his team with this Galactico policy, which eventually, of course, was nonsense. It's a completely different operation now. And I think he learned from his mistakes, even though he was successful then. You know, he had to resign, didn't he, because things were not going too well. And he went through about 10 different managers after he got rid of Del Bosque. So I think he'd learned from then, and he does things a lot differently now.
All right. Still winning, though. Did you ever learn to love Spanish pop?
Yeah, I did. I didn't mind the music. No, I didn't learn to love a particular band. But, you know, when you went to nightclubs, I thought the music was good, actually.
Right.
I thought I really enjoyed it.
Okay.
I really enjoyed it.
All right. And you still get back as often as you can. Real Madrid still, what, sort of second place or third in your heart?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I go back a lot. And, you know, I love the place. I'm involved with Liverpool now. And that's why it was so difficult for me when Liverpool played Real Madrid in finals to pick a team. When you've got so many friends in each camp, and I mean that, so many different friends in each camp, it's very difficult. But I'm still associated with Liverpool. I work at the academy, so I'd always want them to beat Madrid. But Madrid against anybody else, of course I'll take them.
All right, even Everton. Okay.
Well, I spoke with Carlo recently, and he said he adores living in Blundell Sands when he was manager of Everton,
right.
And Everton's his second team and things like that. So he's still got his heart on Liverpool, and I think it meant a lot to the Evertonians that Carlo beat Liverpool. But it was great speaking to him as well. What a gentleman he is.
All right. Well, Stevie, it's been magnificent speaking to you. Such a wonderful ending to, as I say, a brave and bold move, whatever the remunerations, whatever the sweetness of the opportunity to go and play for Real Madrid. There weren't many players who were taking that kind of a decision at that time, and it couldn't have worked out any better. And I think one of the nicest things is that, you know, we've seen other, I mean, even British players go out to Real Madrid and score Champions League winning goals even, and not remain in the hearts of the fans. I mean, one example springs to mind in particular. But you, to this day, I imagine every time you step off the plane in Madrid, you must be absolutely mobbed.
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I get a wonderful reception, mate. And when I go to games, yes, the fans are very, very complimentary about me after games. Yes, they all remember the goal against Valencia. They all remember every single goal in Champions League finals. That's their thing. Mm. We've mentioned it before, but the fans remember it was the 7th, it was the 8th, it was the 9th Champions League. They remember the goal, where it was, what minute it was. It's quite fascinating, really, their level of intellect when it comes to remembering the goals of the past.
Yeah. Special fans, special game, and a very, very special goal from you, Steve El Maka McManaman. Many thanks for being with us today, Steve.
James, thank you very much, as always.
Not at all, not at all.
Sport pods. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. livewithchampion.com.
Tropical Smoothie Cafe welcomes you to Tropic Time. I'll be your concierge. Our beach bites, including made-to-order wraps and bowls, are full of tropic vibes. And our fresh-from-the-blender smoothies make you feel absolutely radiant. It's like a wellness retreat for your taste buds. You're on Tropic Time now at Tropical Smoothie Cafe. Got breakfast plans? At Tropical Smoothie Cafe, hitting your protein goals is a breeze. With our smoothies, bowls, wraps, and diets featuring up to 32 grams of protein.
Lowe's knows that no matter your paint project, saving is at the top of your list. That's why when you shop today, you can buy one, get one free select Valspar and HGTV Home by Sherwin-Williams one coat coverage interior paints via rebate. Shop these deals in-store or online today at Lowe's. We help, you save. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. Discount taken at time of purchase. See sales associate for details. Offer valid 8/21 through 9/3.